You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 18th of March 2024 on Monocle Radio. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Live from London, this is The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson. A very warm welcome to today's programme. Coming up, more talks to try to bring about a ceasefire in Gaza. But will Hamas's plan be accepted? And if so, what are the points in common and the problems? Also ahead.
Democracy doesn't happen by accident. We have to renew it with each generation. And this is an urgent matter on all our parts, in my view.
A summit on the future of democracy will examine what the meeting in South Korea can or cannot achieve. Plus, Nina Dos Santos joins me here with the papers. Good morning, Nina. Only one big global story on
Good
the papers.
Good morning, Emma. Yeah, obviously it's the result of the Russian election, which is, well, surprise, surprise, no surprise, a fait accompli. Another, and this time fifth term for Vladimir Putin, which means that he'll be the longest Russian leader, eclipsing the likes of Joseph Stalin. I think it was in 200 years ago that Russia had a leader who'd been in power this long, and he wasn't even elected because he was a czar.
And can you make happiness a part of law? We'll head to California, which wants to make it part of legislation. That's all ahead on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in today's news. Russia's Vladimir Putin has, as predicted, claimed a landslide victory in the country's presidential elections, claiming 87% of the vote. Swiss police have stopped a far-right politician from speaking at an event. Martin Zellner, who's leader of the Identitarian movement, was classified in 2019 by Germany's Domestic Intelligence Service as an extreme right-wing group. And a state of emergency has been declared in southern Iceland after another volcanic eruption on the Reykjanes Peninsula. Stay tuned to Monocle Radio throughout the day for more on these stories. But first, negotiation teams resumed their work this weekend to try to bring about a ceasefire in the Israel-Hamas conflict. Among those around the table on Sunday were the representatives from the Israeli intelligence agency Mossad, plus Qatar's prime minister and Egyptian officials as well. The talks restarted this weekend after Hamas had put forward a plan to end the violence, but Israel's prime minister has just approved, or over the last few days at least, approved plans for a military assault on Rafah in southern Gaza. Well, I'm joined now from the Jordanian capital Amman by Tahani Mustafa, who's the International Crisis Group's Palestine analyst. A very good morning to you, Tahani.
Good morning.
Just explain to us, I mean, these Israeli negotiators arrived in Qatar yesterday. Just tell us what was happening there.
Well, Hamas have put forward a ceasefire deal, if you like. They put that forward on Friday. Their key demands haven't ultimately changed, but what they are now insisting upon is instead of going straight into a total cessation of hostilities, they're offering a 40-day pause whereby you can begin the process of a hostage exchange deal. And then hopefully from there, that can then lead to a more permanent ceasefire. And then other logistics will then be figured out, like Israeli withdrawal of Gaza, allowing unlimited aid into the Strip, and so forth. Initially, I mean, what was interesting was that Netanyahu just Saturday had claimed that Hamas was still insisting on putting forward unrealistic demands. And then, you know, suddenly we see yesterday, Israel sending a delegation to Qatar, despite Netanyahu outright rejecting the deal on Saturday.
What do you think this means? Because we also heard last night that Benjamin Netanyahu had rejected calls to avoid a ground offensive into Rafah, which is what so many people are very worried about.
Well, he's already made quite a few statements now claiming that that ground invasion will go ahead. The question really isn't if, it's when. And he's already approved plans to do so, which makes this delegation even more kind of suspect now, especially given that the gap between the two parties to the conflict, Israel and Hamas, still remains intractable. That hasn't changed despite this delegation. You know, Netanyahu's comments are very much to that effect. He's still calling Hamas's demands despite Hamas trying to provide some leeway here, as unrealistic. And really what it comes down to is that for Israel, it wants the complete destruction of Hamas. And for Hamas, they want the total and permanent cessation of hostilities. And that's exactly what this new proposal is still demanding. So, you know, whether we'll actually see any breakthrough is it's not looking very likely, especially considering the fact that Netanyahu has not only approved plans for Rafah, but we're also now seeing the US still very reluctant to put any red lines, still equipping Israel militarily, while also now trying to kind of, you know, sort of peddle this this new process of bringing aid in through air and sea.
Just tell us a little bit about what you mentioned there, about modification of demands. I mean, Hamas has abandoned some of its demands, hasn't it? What are they, and why did they leave them?
Well, they haven't completely abandoned those demands. They have changed the sequencing of those demands. So now, instead of calling for a total cessation of hostilities, what they are asking for is a pause that will, they're hoping, put Israel in a bind by the time you have a hostage release deal, or by the time you have the exchange of hostages at the end of that 40-day period. Israel really won't have much recourse other than ceding to a permanent ceasefire. But it is still calling for the withdrawal of Israeli troops. It is still calling for unlimited access to aid and reconstruction. And those haven't changed. Those have been the pillar of their demands. In terms of the release of Palestinian prisoners, that still very much remains consistent to previous deals that Hamas have put forward, especially the last deal that it rejected, where Israel had proposed a 6-week pause in fighting in exchange for a ratio of 10 Palestinian prisoners to one Israeli hostage. And that's very much what Hamas have put on the table in the interim. But those aren't, that is not meant to be the final permanent deal.
Tell us a little bit more about developments in internal Palestinian politics. There is now a new prime minister with Mohammed Mustafa trying to take over. Just explain to us what kind of control any of the internal politicians inside Gaza have of what's going on?
There's very little control right now in terms of what Hamas or the PA really have over Gaza. We have seen the new appointment of the PA prime minister, but that's really intended more for the day after as opposed to now, or at least in the interim. Again, it's very unlikely that the PA is going to be able to fully, you know, take control over governance and service provision, even if we're talking about in the more immediate term, if we do see any kind of pause or cessation of hostility, simply because the PA does not have the capacity to, it doesn't have the actual logistic capability to, especially in a place like Gaza, which has been made an ungovernable wasteland at this point. So to assume that someone like Mohammed Mustafa is going to be leading on those initiatives is, I think, somewhat misguided. I think what we will end up seeing is service provision in the hands of humanitarian aid agencies until the PA or until things are at least running enough so that the PA is able to take some control over service provision. But ultimately, this really doesn't change much. And I think this is where Palestinian objections to this new cabinet reshuffle and these new appointments is coming in. The PA still remains financially destitute. The Israelis have still imposed an economic siege on the West Bank. There are still restrictions on the freedom of movement, which Israel has not implied that it will be removing anytime soon. You may have an influx of money coming in, but what do you do with that money if the PA doesn't even have the basis of legitimacy amongst its own people? Worse yet, Palestinian factions have issued a statement on Saturday, the same day as the official appointment of the new prime minister, rejecting his appointment, claiming that it violates democratic consensus, unity, and effectively changes nothing, where power still remains in the hands of Mahmoud Abbas and his two lieutenants close to him.
Tell us a little bit more. I mean, you touched earlier on the difficulty in getting aid into Gaza, but just bring us up to date, please, on the international efforts to try to get ships in, things being allowed to pass through Rafah. What exactly is the state of play at the moment?
Well, you're still seeing, humanitarian aid supplies that are being allowed to enter the Strip. I think now it's something like 125 aid trucks are being allowed in through land crossings. That's a fraction of what was going in before the 7th of October, where you were seeing something like 500 trucks a day. Now it's something like 125. But still, and those 125 aid trucks are carrying something like 20 tons of aid. Again, still insufficient, considering not only are you dealing with a population of 2.2 million, but obviously now, given the onslaught, their needs are going to be much greater. So, you know, we're still seeing humanitarian aid supplies that remain inadequate to meet the population's needs. Aid agencies are warning of an imminent famine. You've got, you know, numerous instances we've seen over March where starving Palestinians who had tried to access aid convoys that had been denied access for the previous 4 weeks before that were met with Israeli live fire. And worse yet, Israel has now imposed arbitrary restrictions preventing critical supplies from entering the Strip through those land crossings. So that includes things like anesthetics, ventilators, water purification tablets, sleeping bags, sanitary towels. You know, the list goes on. You now have several countries, including Belgium, the US, Jordan, that have tried to airdrop supplies into the Gaza Strip to elevate some of that, you know, humanitarian suffering and crisis. And to get around the highly restrictive procedures for getting aid in to the territory by land. But again, the quantity of aid, the quality of aid that's being delivered in this way has been minuscule compared to what Gazans actually need. I mean, if I'm not sure how many of your listeners have actually followed some of the images coming out of Gaza, what those actual aid packages have entailed, things like chewing gum, Skittles, you know, vanilla powdered drinks and peanut butter and crackers. I mean, that is not sufficient to deal with a population that are on the verge of starvation and famine, right, and are severely malnourished. And so you've had a lot of criticism now being leveled at these countries, you know, criticism that this is a mere sticking plaster, right? You know, and worse yet, UNRWA has come out and said that these forms of trying to go around these restrictive measures for getting aid in, into the territory, bypassing land crossings that already exist, are inefficient. They're not economical and they're completely unsafe. And that has been proven true. We've seen several Gazans who've been killed in these aid drops, where there have been reports that Israeli air forces have also bombed the location of aid drops. That happened a few days ago with the when the Belgians tried to conduct an airdrop of supplies. Now you're seeing the US going in to build a port to facilitate the entry of aid. Again, there's criticism that, first of all, it's going to take something like 2 months, which doesn't meet the urgency of need, as well as the significant expense that's entailed when you already have existing means through land that can get just as much, if not more efficient, mechanisms of aid and supplies in.
Tahani, thank you so much for joining us on the line from Amman in Jordan. That was Tahani Mustafa there. You're listening to The Globalist. In Seoul, 7:13 a.m. here in London. Now, 2024 has been widely billed as the year of the election, as more than 60 countries, collectively home to nearly half of the world's population of 8 billion people, have held or are scheduled to vote in national polls. So this year's Democracy Summit, held this week in the South Korean capital of Seoul, arguably holds more importance than ever. So why, as events get underway, is there such criticism of its usefulness? Well, I'm joined now by Bruno Kaufmann, who's global democracy correspondent at the Swiss Broadcasting Company. Very good morning. Welcome back, Bruno.
Good morning, Emma.
So just explain the premise of the Democracy Summit. It was set up by the Biden administration, wasn't it?
That's right. And it was an initiative by the US president personally, you can say, a very bold initiative, basically to bring together democracy supporting governments, organizations and stakeholders globally. And this was very much informed by the backsliding we have seen on basic democratic pillars like the rule of law and free and fair elections. And but also about, you can say, the failed insurrection against Congress in the US on January 6th. 26, 2021. So this has been a process led by Biden and by the US administration, and it has seen two summits until now. One was in the United States, and then last year it was spread around the world in different parts of the world at the same time.
South Korea, South Korea took part in that one, didn't it? But this is the first time that a country outside the United States hosts the summit single-handedly. Why is South Korea such a big player in this?
Of course, South Korea is a big friend of the United States, and the current president, the conservative president Yoon Suk-yeol, he was taking on this hosting role last year when South Korea, together with others, were co-hosting the second summit. And of course, South Korea is really at this kind of borderline between democracy and autocracy. As just a few kilometers north of Seoul, you have the border to North Korea, one of the most autocratic regime. So South Korea was proud to announce to be the host of this third summit.
And when we think about the people who are being brought together, the Biden administration's original desire was to bring together governments, NGO stakeholders, and all of them, as you say, trying to create a counterweight against backsliding of democracies. When you bring a bunch of like-minded people together, it is going to be a rather large talking shop of agreement, isn't it?
It could be. And of course, this is always a risk when you have basically nice words about democracy, how important it is. But this summit process was also, as it was so inclusive, you can say there were more than 100 governments, more than 100 different democracies trying to find out how they can support each another, how they can support democracy at home. But this is, at the same time, you can say, and this is shown now through this third summit, a very ambivalent exercise. And South Korea is maybe the best example, as they now, when they organized and hosted this summit, they have been extremely cautious, basically, to include people at home, but also globally. I mean, just 2 days ago, the program of the summit wasn't yet published online, and it was also a lot of skepticism to involve the civil society at home, as South Korea also have an election coming up on April 10, and the current president is fearing that the opposition could win this election. And when you see now how the summit, which started this morning in Seoul, is spread around the world, it's a very limited, you can say, public. I mean, I'm just following the live stream from Seoul, and while earlier summits there were thousands and hundreds of thousands of people following it, just now there are 45 people following this summit from around the world, including your correspondent.
Which perhaps questions its usefulness.
Yes, that's right. I mean, it seems to be that it's an issue which at this moment again and again shows that democracy as such is, of course, a universal value, and most people really value it, and you can see it in opinion polls around the world. But again, I mean, governments in power very often see democracy as a useful tool when it fits them, but they are not as interested when it doesn't fit their interest. And you see that very clearly in the attitude of the Biden administration. While it was very useful after January 6th, and it was very useful for the foreign policy approach of President Biden in the first years, now in this year, when there is an election coming up in November, the Biden administration looks inward. And in the US, you can see that democracy support around the world is really not a priority of most people. There are opinion polls by Pew Research who shows that only about one-fifth, about 20%, sees this as an important foreign policy priority. And you can contrast it to countries like my own home country, Switzerland, where four-fifths of the people, 80%, sees at importance. So you can see that the smaller a country is, the less powerful, the more interested you are in this kind of rule of law and democracy around the world, as, of course, stakeholders outside government, like global businesses and local people, for them, democracy remains a very important value.
Why has democracy lacked so much importance, and why has it lost its teeth?
Yeah, because it's of course, you have the great idea of democracy, you have the great idea of power sharing, but in the reality, of course, these ideas are never really fulfilled. So it depends on who is in power, who is following up these universal values. We are celebrating last year the 75th anniversary of the Human Rights Declaration, which, based on the experiences of the Second World War, really underlined these basic values of human security, of human participation. But again, now we see so many autocratic governments. We just experienced the election in Russia, which was, of course, an election conducted according to the rules there, but where the context is so undemocratic that it hasn't any value anymore to the people. So we see a big risk of undermining these great ideas of democracy. So it will be very dependent now how, for instance, democracy is developed according to the values in the different countries where you have big elections like India, European Union and the US. But you can really say today democracy is in trouble, as it is the summit for democracy.
Who can or who is counteracting this, or where can there be signs that democracy is flourishing and pushing back?
You see it when you look onto the big rankings of democracy, which have been published recently through the Economist Intelligence Unit and Varieties of Democracy. You see that especially in smaller countries around the world, you see counteractions. I mean, we have seen the election in Taiwan and the development there. We see it in a place like Mongolia between Russia and China. We see it in many European smaller countries, but also in countries like Uruguay, or Belize. So you see that there are really countries counteracting, and maybe this is the place where this kind of hosting of summits of democracy should take place and not in the bigger countries like the US or even now in the case of South Korea.
Bruno Kaufmann, thank you so much as ever for joining us on Monocle Radio. Still to come on today's programme.
It's a opportunistic way of collecting, but that's how we managed to have one of the biggest collection of Olympic artifacts. We are literally at the Games.
We'll hear about the so-called heritage hunters who compete for memorabilia for the Olympics for their museums. Stay with us on The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
Let's continue now with today's newspapers. Joining me in the studio is the international broadcast correspondent Nina Dos Santos and regular voice around the microphones here at Monocle Radio. Hello, Nina.
Good morning.
How's life in the Dos Santos world?
Yeah, well, good. Thanks, everybody. Galvanised by the outcome of the Russian elections. Oh, what a surprise that was.
It's a question. It's an interesting word, the use of galvanised, because, we've just heard from Bruno Kaufmann this terrible fear that there's a backsliding of democracy. He said that there are only 47 people watching the Global Democracy Summit, which was clearly taking some tremendous organisation, hopes to have a major impact. Whereas, as you said, as you were walking into the room to sit down, no one's watching that. They're all watching Putin.
Yeah, that's right. They're watching the spectacle of autocrats being able to get away with what might have been unthinkable. And, you know, just above my television set, by the way, Emma, is this little bunch of Russian nesting dolls that I bought in the mid-2000s on my first reporting trip to Moscow. And what was really interesting is that it has, you know, a couple of Soviet leaders up until Yeltsin. You open up the next set of dolls and it just goes Putin, 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 Putin. And I thought, gosh, this was quite prophetic when I bought it back in the mid-2000s. And here we are now. He's already been in charge for 25 years, just via a landslide, quote unquote, gaining 87, 88% of the vote, according to, polls that were neither free nor fair, according to the US. And he could be in charge for longer than people like Joseph Stalin. It really is a terrifying prospect. And now the pressure on the international community, not least the United States and here in the UK, is to declare these elections null and void and to say that they have no legitimacy whatsoever. Like, for instance, has been done in the case of Belarus's elections in the past. That might be a step too far because obviously Russia is a huge country and, you know, it has very bellicose president at the moment who, legitimately elected or not, might cause some real problems for the West, given obviously the fact that he invaded Ukraine 2 years ago and might go further from here, emboldened by this election result.
It's an unusual thing to do a paper review of a story that we all knew the outcome of before it was even written.
Well,
so how are people talking about it?
I suppose it's better than writing it as a fact, right, as news, because obviously, as we can see here, you know, the media landscape has been extremely curtailed in Russia in the run-up to this election. Obviously, not being able to call the war in Ukraine a war a couple of years ago was the start of that sort of descent of media freedoms. But already a year into this election, a year away from this election, sorry, I should say, Vladimir Putin already started banning independent journalists from being able to report on it in a free manner. Now, there has been a valiant show of protest inside of Russia at great personal peril by Russian citizens, I might add, and also elsewhere. Alexei Navalny's supporters, the late opposition leader, and of course his wife, Yulia Navalny, have been urging people to gather outside of polling stations at midday in the form of a silent protest. And there were, you know, plenty of images showing that these polling stations were swamped. And that just goes to show how that message of turning up in numbers and protesting with the strength of the crowd behind you, you know, still gains some traction in Russia, but it is a very, very difficult thing to do. Russians trying to spoil their ballots in various ways they can, voting for the cat, for instance, writing The Hague on some of their ballots, you know, in reference to the International Criminal Court's investigation over what's happening in Ukraine. But the pressure now, again, will be on the international community to, you know, denounce Vladimir Putin's stranglehold over power in such a crucial country around the world.
So when we start looking at the way that the papers are covering it, I mean, I'm just touching on a couple of Hungarian, for example, national newspapers, and its headline is Vladimir Putin, one of the main presidential goals is to fulfil the tasks of the special operations. The president thanked the volunteers of his election team and the voters for their trust and unity expressed in the votes. No great surprise, but this is a Hungarian newspaper, Hungary part of the European Union.
But it has few media freedoms, I might add.
This is a majorly pro-government paper, and we see a clampdown on freedom of speech in Hungary. And you think, actually, this is the narratives among the media can be really, really quickly changed over from country to country, from border to border.
And remember, even in the United States, where there's extreme media freedom, you know, there are some people who sympathise with Vladimir Putin on the right of the Republican Party and on the further right of the sort of political spectrum in the media as well. Look at Tucker Carlson, the spectacle of the former Fox News anchor heading over to Moscow to do that interview with Vladimir Putin before Alexei Navalny was killed. And speaking of which, what was important over the last 24 hours is that in his victory speech, for the first time, we saw Vladimir Putin name check Alexei Navalny and say, well, you know, I was going to actually swap him in a prisoner swap, but what a shame, he died just before that. He said, quote unquote, life is like that. And it made me think, well, it's not your life and he's no longer alive. He's dead.
It was an astonishing moment that actually, but give something for the Western media, or give something almost for the pro-Navalny and those fighting Putin, something to hold on to because now he said his name.
That's true. And, you know, we saw Alexei Navalny's wife, Yulia Navalnaya, his widow, you know, take on a very prominent role over the last few weeks since his death. And she was out there in Berlin casting her vote in a very, very prominent manner. That's a very sort of strong optical show of defiance against Vladimir Putin. He will obviously try and paint her and other members of the Russian opposition who are, say, here in London, members of the Belarusian opposition like Svetlana Tikhanovskaya over in Lithuania as, you know, as running a parallel US-sponsored, quote-unquote, he might claim, operation to undermine Russia's democracy from outside of Russia's borders. But the reality is that, you know, Russia is, as we know already, viewed as an international pariah. It is heavily sanctioned. And the real question here now is, from a geopolitical point of view, you've got essentially the Baltic Sea is like a NATO lake. Russia's nuclear armaments in Kaliningrad, in that Baltic port, essentially are drifting off into their own orbit. They're surrounded by NATO territory now. What is Vladimir Putin going to do about that? The Baltic states are very, very concerned that he might be tempted to make a reach over into NATO territory, freshly emboldened from, you know, election results like this, where he faces no opposition at home.
Let's touch on that in an article that you wanted to draw our attention to this morning, which is the idea of Estonia now becoming one of the first countries in the region, in that part of the world, to back up a plea by Emmanuel Macron, or an assertion by Emmanuel Macron, that forces from within the European Union may well end up going to Ukraine.
Yes, now this all started when Macron hosted a summit of leaders in Paris a couple of weeks ago to talk about, you know, the conflict in Ukraine, how to get more weaponry to Ukraine, to help Ukraine. Remember that Macron had been facing a lot of criticism in years gone by for trying to placate President Putin, a sort of Chamberlain-type moment was what he was accused of, and he now wants to sort of reset the balance, not least because France is a huge maker of weaponry, and it's uniquely placed to try and protect Europe and also try and protect, as I said, NATO's eastern border and to help Ukraine. And he's changed his tack quite abruptly, saying that suddenly, well, you know, we could position some sort of forces inside Ukraine's territory. That immediately had Germany on high alert. The German Chancellor, other countries like Czechia, it immediately rebuffed that suggestion. They thought that that would inflame matters and stoke the ire of the Russian bear, so to speak. But Macron is not backing down, and he's finding some allies in the likes of the Baltic countries who, for a couple of months now, have been saying, we're literally 3 years away from Putin invading our territory, which, by the way, is not just EU territory, it's also NATO territory. So, you know, he is finding some traction. It's looking as though he won't back down. But if you look behind the scenes, this isn't really about demining operations, I suspect, which is what now Macron claims he's talking about. He's saying we're not talking about combat troops in Ukraine. What it is about getting troops into position in case Vladimir Putin does decide to try and attack NATO territory. Wherever you are across Europe, speaking to somebody who's familiar with the UK military planning just last week, and they were also saying the British Army is trying to figure out how he'll get people to places that we need in the next 3 days, if indeed Vladimir Putin does decide to pass the Rubicon, so to speak.
Nina Dos Santos, I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining me in the studio. The time here in London is just nudging 7:33 a.m. You're listening to The Globalist. A quick look now at some of the other stories we're keeping an eye on today. Russia's Vladimir Putin has, as predicted, claimed a landslide victory in the country's presidential election. Claiming 87% of the vote, there was never any doubt that he'd win, as all credible opposition had been wiped out. Speaking after the election results projected the landslide victory, President Putin praised China for its success on the world stage and warned there was no democracy in the West, including in the United States. Swiss police have stopped a far-right politician from speaking at an event. Martin Zellner, who's the leader of the Identitarian movement, was classified in 2019 by Germany's domestic intelligence service as an extreme right-wing group. He travelled to Tegerfelder in the Swiss canton of Aargau to present an event organised by a Swiss group called Junger Tat, or Young Deed. And a state of emergency has been declared in southern Iceland after another volcanic eruption on the Reykjanes Peninsula. It's the fourth such eruption since December. The Icelandic Met Office says lava has reached the eastern defences around the small town of Grindavik. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Now, Egypt has found itself recently in a very difficult geographical trap. To the south, it borders with Sudan, where a brutal civil war is playing out. To the west is Libya, split into factions since 2011 and a source of deep civil unrest. And then since October the 7th, the Egyptian border with Gaza has become the only point of access and exit from the Gaza Strip. As a result, Cairo has struggled with a rise in illegal migration, but now it could be the recipient of a significant financial help from the European Union to try to combat this. Well, I'm joined by Ruth Michelson, journalist and Middle East correspondent. A very good morning to you, Ruth.
Morning, Emma.
Now, the reason why we're talking about this is that the European Union's representatives were in Egypt this weekend to try to work out the terms of this deal that would allow an enormous amount of money to head to Egypt.
Yes, unprecedented amount of money. I mean, this is £6.3 billion, €7.4 billion. And in the words of the European Commission President, Ursula von der Leyen, who was the head of this delegation to Cairo to discuss this deal, she said that the deal was about the fact that Egypt is, in her words, a very troubled neighborhood, and it plays a vital role in the stability of the region. That is absolutely true. But as you mentioned, this is a deal that really, in the end, is about migration. And it is a deal that is built on the idea that Europe fears migrants from Sudan, from Syria, and even from Gaza coming into Europe, and therefore providing enormous amounts of money to an autocratic regime, receiving a lot of criticism, understandably, from groups like Human Rights Watch for doing so.
Indeed. I mean, what does Cairo stand to get out of all this?
Well, Egypt has had a prolonged economic crisis, and it's also important to say that that economic crisis is, you know, largely dependent on choices made by President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi and his regime. For example, investing at least $60 billion in building a new capital, in mega projects that he has told the Egyptian people will bring wealth to the country, but instead, you know, his rule since 2013 has really seen an increasingly this concentration of wealth around people at the very top, mostly in the security services and the military, and desperate situation, rising poverty for the vast majority of Egyptians. And we've seen recently the devaluation of the currency, that Egypt has begun selling off some state assets. This deal from the EU comes at the same time as they just signed a deal worth about $35 billion with the UAE to sell off some land in the north of the country. The Egyptian regime is desperately clamoring for injections of foreign currency. There's been a prolonged foreign currency crisis. And, you know, while this is happening, they're doing this essentially to try and bring this foreign currency in to plug these enormous financial holes due to Sisi's poor investment choices. So the estimation was that Egypt owed about $30 billion just to pay off some of its debts this coming year. And these efforts at bringing in this foreign currency and bringing in this investment are designed as a way to kind of, you know, plug these huge financial gaps. But what it actually means is that the debt just kind of keeps rolling on. Egypt is the second largest debtor to the IMF after Argentina.
How does the European Union square the circle of a major need of investment into Egypt, a concern within Europe of having to deal with the sort of the end point of illegal migration? But at the same time, you mentioned a moment ago that Egypt's leader, el-Sisi, is an autocrat and that there are human rights issues, severe ones.
I mean, I think we've seen a pattern here, largely connected to Ursula von der Leyen, of what critics, including other members of the European Parliament, have called, you know, her choice to bankroll dictators. This is very similar to a recent deal that the EU cut with Tunisia, where the Kais Saied, the Tunisian president, is also accused of increasingly running the country in an autocratic fashion. And, you know, just last week, I mean, literally days before von der Leyen flew to Cairo with Giorgia Meloni and other figures from the European Union, leaders who have increasingly backed Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. You know, just before that, there was the accusation that the money that the European Union has given to Tunisia has basically been entirely kept by Kais Saied when in that example. And so the EU has bankrolled Egypt several times before, not necessarily to the same amount as they have done this time. And it hasn't made the changes that the EU has promised. It hasn't stopped migration, which is their great paranoia. And instead, what it's done is just allowed the regime to keep moving forward, to keep wasting money on these mega projects, to keep concentrating wealth around the top of the country. And so there really is a question of what is the purpose of this investment other than to relay these fears about migration within Europe, even though there's very little evidence that this money is likely to change anything.
Ruth Michelson, thank you as ever for joining us on Monocle Radio. You're listening to The Globalist. Now to Paris, where the renowned LA-based artist Alison Sarr has been chosen to recreate a sculpture that will be installed in the French capital to honour the legacy of the 2024 Olympics. It's one of the many programmes aimed at showcasing the culture and diversity of the Games alongside the sports competitions and to foster connections between past, future and current host cities. On Monocle's Laura Kramer headed to the Olympic capital of Lausanne in Switzerland to meet one of the key figures of the initiative. Angelita Toe is the director of the Olympic Foundation for Culture and Heritage, the Arts and Cultural Division of the IOC, which includes the Olympic Museum and the Olympic Studies Centre. And she began by telling Laura what's in store for this year's Games.
The work that myself and my team have been preparing for Paris have started more than 2 years ago, working closely with Paris 2024 to ensure that the cultural programme is diverse, it's inclusive, as well as we have a lot of long-term projects as well that spans host cities that's only not only in Paris. So one of the main key strategy for our department is to not only ensure that what happens during the Games, but also the continuation after the game as well with some of these cultural and community projects that we have going on.
Can you give me some examples of those?
So, for example, in Paris, we have a legacy sculpture. And this sculpture program started in Tokyo, where we had a French artist, Xavier Villon, who actually have created a beautiful permanent sculpture in Nihonbashi in Tokyo. In Paris, we are currently working with a American LA-based artist. As you know, the next host city for the Summer Games will be in LA. And I guess you can see the continuation there. And in LA, we will be working with the Australian artists and so on. So it's really about having discussions between artists, between art communities around the world. Hopefully, after 10 editions, this will be a rather exciting program that you can have around the world. So I think this is something that we're looking forward to. It's the conversation that continues from game to game. A lot of these work that we do has to span years. And I think that's important from a cultural perspective because we want to be able to create a lasting relationship, which is why we emphasize on not just what's happening during the games, before the games and after the games and, you know, even decades down. I mean, take Paris, for example. This is the third edition after almost 100 years. Since the last game. First was in 1900 and then 1924 and then 2024. So all these kind of long-term relationship is really important to maintain for the Olympic movement as a whole.
What are you most looking forward to for Paris 2024?
Everything. You know, the build-up. I mean, the team has worked so hard. We have our own projects. We have collaboration. It's being able to show everybody that the Olympic Games goes beyond the competitions. There is a team of heritage hunters where they go and collect memorabilia, equipment from the athletes during the Games. So I think they are hoping to get more artifacts for the collection. I've heard of stories where they literally, you know, take jerseys of the athletes off the back and it could be wet and sweaty and they put it in a Ziploc bag and they'll bring it back to Lausanne. and so on. It's a very opportunistic way of collecting, but that's how we managed to have one of the biggest collection of Olympic artifacts. Is we are literally at the games.
Who are the heritage hunters?
So they are
intrigued.
So these heritage hunters are actually either full-time conservators or curators at the museum. So during the games, they're out there hunting for new things for the collection.
And do they also have to train in order to be able to run up to them really quickly to get these artifacts?
It's really that there is a science behind it as well, because they have to look at the competition, who is winning. They have to kind of make a judgment call. I mean, they can't be everywhere, so they have to decide which matches they have to show up and so on. So they all kind of brainstorm the night before, deciding where they will be going separately. So it's quite an exciting endeavor.
How competitive is it? Are they fighting against other heritage hunters from other organizations?
Yes, they are. You're right. We have Olympic Museum Network. And there are a lot of museums out there. I mean, they may not be Olympic museum, but also sports museums from different countries who are also trying to collect from their sports athletes as well to go into their collection. So our hunters always remind them, we are at international level. So would you like your collection to be with us? We do get a lot of donation on site in Lausanne as well. So Olympians do come, they do donate. And we do this thing called Words of Olympians. So we also interview a lot of Olympians to get their first-hand reaction from the games. So this will be happening in Paris at the same time.
Now, for you, what would make a really successful Paris 2024?
I truly, truly believe that it will be an amazing games. There's a lot of expectations after Tokyo. I think for my team, just being able to be there in Paris, to witness the games, to be involved with the various activities and programs that they have spent months, if not years, working on, to see people enjoying them, to see, you know, happy faces and excitement all around. I think for us, I think that is really what we are hoping to achieve. It's just bringing that joy to people.
And that was Angelita Teo there in conversation with Monocle's Laura Kramer. This is The Globalist on Monocle Radio.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
It's time now for a roundup of climate news with Monocle contributing editor Sheena Rossiter joining on the line now from Edmonton. A very good evening to you, Sheena.
Hello.
Right, so one of the big issues that often people talk about is the climate impact of growing coffee. But there are some coffee growers in Vietnam who are trying to mitigate any climate damage that can be caused.
Yeah, as a huge coffee drinker myself, we have been hearing for a while that the Arabica coffee bean is starting to get endangered basically because of the impacts of climate change. And that bean mostly grows in Africa, Latin America, and parts of Asia. But Vietnamese coffee growers, that is actually where they grow the Robusta bean. And that's the largest bean that they produce in that country, Brazil being the second largest producer of it. And in Vietnam, 95 to 97% of the coffee beans that they produce in that country are this Robusta bean. So the bean has been in Vietnam for a while. It's been around since colonial times when the French brought it over back in the 1850s. But it tolerates higher temperatures, basically 22 to 30 degrees Celsius, when the Arabica bean typically grows between 15 to 20 degrees Celsius. It's also less resistant to disease, insects, and also different types of fungi. So studies have shown that by 2050, as much as about 50% of the land that's used to grow Arabica beans today, it's not going to be so suitable for production. So Vietnam is already trying to get ahead of this and looking to produce more of this Robusta bean as temperatures rise globally and the coffee industry looks to transform itself.
Okay, let's move on to a story in the United States, in Massachusetts. Working hard to fend off the impacts of climate change. What happened?
Yeah, well, this story, the irony is certainly not lost on me for this one. Some 150 homeowners in this small coastal town in Massachusetts, just north of Boston, basically, they fundraised about $600,000 to build a sand dune. And the reason why they were doing this is because the Atlantic Ocean is ever so inching closer to their homes on the coast there. So they put up this dune in order to keep the ocean back a little bit. It was constructed on March 7th, and just 3 days later, 15,000 tons of sand was washed away in the worst storm that they had seen in about 50 years. And the funds that were raised to build this dune, about half of them, so $300,000, were personal funds from the residents, and between 150 residents, that's about $4,000 per household that paid for this dune. So this is just a classic example of no matter how much money we throw towards some of these natural disasters and extreme weather events, it's going to keep impacting the economy, especially in the U.S. in the next 10 years, 20 years. But it doesn't matter how much money that you throw to this, you can't fend off climate change. So other factors really need to be done in order to mitigate the effects.
Thanks for that. Let's head north of the border to Canada. What's happening there?
Yeah, so the price hike on carbon tax, it's really making huge rumbles across the country. In Canada here, we already have a carbon tax put in place that the federal Liberal government has put in place, but that's looking to increase at the start of next month. So beginning April 1st, the federal government will be increasing the price on carbon pollution by $15 per ton, continuing with its plan to increase it each year until 2030. That means that the carbon tax will be 17 cents more per liter, 21 cents per liter of diesel, and 15 cents per cubic meter of natural gas. And the Trudeau government has said that this strategy is meant to reduce emissions and encourage more innovation by having more green solutions. But not every group and every part of the Canadian population is really on board with this.
No, I mean, how are Canadians reacting to this?
Well, according to the polls, about 7 out of 10 Canadians are against this latest carbon tax increase. So a study that was done by the Canadian Taxpayer Federation, also known as a CTF, they released these results this past week, saying that with this upcoming hike, 69% of respondents are opposed to it, while just 31% support it. And that's excluding Quebec and BC, those two jurisdictions where the tax isn't directly applied. The group of Canadians against the tax tends to be about 72% when you exclude BC and Quebec. So Canada's already been experiencing huge inflation when it comes to food prices are just going up and up, and there is a housing crisis as well. So just the idea of things costing more, a lot of Canadians just simply aren't on board with that.
And how's the government reacted to all this?
Well, provincially, provincial premiers across the country have protested the increase. Here in Alberta, they're against it. Next door in Saskatchewan, they have also protested and been against it as well. They've said that it's going to raise taxes by $80 per ton from $65. And the federal government has countered this argument by saying that 8 out of 10 Canadians do actually receive more tax rebates than they shell out to pay for the tax in the first place. Now, the carbon tax has been put in place as a primary point of attack for the federal conservative leader Pierre Poilievre, who's called this the spike hike. And it's basically going to be used as a huge political tool, especially with a federal election expected to take place in October 2025. And a lot of Canadians will be keeping an eye on this, and this will be top of mind as Trudeau's popularity continues to go down and in other parts of the country where more conservative powers tend to be in play. But it is just being used as a political tool at this moment rather than what it's supposed to be used for, which is ultimately to help help combat pollution and bring down those carbon emissions.
Sheena Rossiter, thank you so much for joining us on the line from Edmonton. You're listening to The Globalist on Monocle Radio. Finally, if there's arguably something to make the average person lose their temper, it's to be told to cheer up. Such is the elusive, mutable and slippery nature of happiness. So let's wish the very best of luck then to California, as it creates a select committee on happiness and public policy outcomes. Its aim is to examine how policymaking in the state could make people happier. Well, Sir Geoff Mulgan is Professor of Collective Intelligence, Public Policy and Social Innovation at University College London, and he also founded Action for Happiness, a charity that promotes a happier and more caring society. A very good morning to you, Geoff. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi there. Good to be with you.
So do we know what California's idea of happiness is?
Well, I don't think it will probably differ greatly from anywhere else. And I hope this committee will learn from 20 years or so of experiment around the world of trying to shift the goals of government from primarily things like GDP to actually well-being in all its forms. And a lot has been done. I first wrote a paper for the UK government over 20 years ago on this. Some countries have had ministers of happiness, United Arab Emirates. Some, like New Zealand, had tried to use happiness to reframe all of their budgets under Jacinda Ardern. Countries like Finland have tried to reshape their social security. So it's become a lot more specific, perhaps, than a few years ago. And it takes you to lots of different issues, from unemployment to loneliness to commuting times and so on. And it seems to me it should be just common sense for any government to be concerned about the happiness and well-being of its people, even if telling people to cheer up is not usually a very good idea.
No, so do we? I wonder whether happiness, therefore, is the right word here, because you were talking there about, you know, contentment, stability, quality of life, a slightly more long-term feeling of a sort of intelligent policy making with the citizen in mind.
Yeah, so there was a huge amount of work done in the 2000s on how you could measure happiness, or indeed whether you could measure it. The UK's statistical agency started measuring in 2010, but trying to distinguish several things, one of which was happiness in the moment, one of which was your satisfaction with life as a whole, and they're different things, but also measuring things like anxiety. And this means we've now got far more data on the state of happiness of the public, but also, I mean, crucially, the differences between areas, between men and women, different age groups, and so on. The policy world hasn't quite caught up with any of this, but the same happened in economics. It took years after GDP started being measured before governments really got to grips with how to run economic policies. But that's the direction of travel. And hopefully California can pioneer some new ways of using this kind of data to actually make people happier.
Explain to us how that data might be used then.
Well, I think the most important thing is seeing who's really struggling. And around the world, there's lots of interest in what's now called population level mental health. So what can you do, not just for the perhaps 1, 2, 3% of people really struggling with severe depression, schizophrenia and so on, but can you help the maybe 10, 20, 30% struggling with anxiety or depression? Now, that wasn't a task which any governments at the state level or national level set themselves in the past. They were concerned much more with physical health than mental health. But once you start looking in these terms, you start thinking about different kinds of services, community-based services, online services. What can you do in schools to spot better when teenagers are really struggling? Countries like Finland have had amazing suicide reduction strategies. They've roughly halved suicides in recent years. So we're moving into new territories, which really are all about the human, about psychology, rather than just about physical stuff and money.
Sir Geoff Mulgan, thank you so much for joining us here on The Globalist. And that's all the time we have for today's programme. The warmest of thanks to all my guests and to our producers, Laura Kramer, Chris Chermak and Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. Our researcher was George Ruskin and our studio manager was Mariella Bevan. After the headlines, there's more music on the way. The briefing's live at midday here in London. The Globalist is back at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening. And I leave you with Pharrell. If you feel like happiness.